Researchers from University College London, University of Lund in Sweden, University of British Columbia, and the University of Washington in Seattle have gained a new understanding of how changes in the immune system can foreshadow the expression of Huntington's disease by up to 16 years. Research on this fatal neurodegenerative disease was published online in the Journal of Experimental Medicine and shed some light on possible therapies that would target the immune system. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Blair Levitt, Senior Research Neurologist and Scientist at the Center for Molecular Medicine and Therapeutics, Child and Family Research Institute at BC Children's Hospital, Director of the Canadian Genetic Disease Network Transgenic Core Facility, Associate Professor, Department of Medical Genetics at UBC, and Neurologist at UBC Neurogenetics and Huntington's Disease Medical Clinics. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What is the incidence and prevalence of Huntington's disease?
So in the Canadian population, the prevalence data is probably a little bit easier to give you. And it's it's about 1 in 10,000 individuals is affected by Huntington's disease in a North American or a Canadian population. You know, this is a genetic disorder. It's caused by a single gene that we know exactly who carries the gene and who doesn't based on genetic testing. And so the incidence is quite a different beast in this disease because people have the gene throughout life. And that's actually one of the things I imagine we'll talk a fair bit about today.
So how and when does the disease express itself?
So Huntington's disease has a very distinct and unusual genetic basis. It's caused by a change in a gene that we all have. We all have two copies of the Huntington gene in our body. Each one of us has two copies of the gene, one we inherited from our mother and one we inherited from our father. And within this gene that makes an important protein for our body, there's a stretch of repeated elements. And it's the size of these repeated elements that determines whether or not someone will have Huntington's disease. And so this repeated element, and it's called a CAG trinucleotide repeat, when this gets expanded and is large, greater than 39 or greater than 36 of these repeats in the gene, it will cause Huntington's disease at some point in the person's life. What's important to understand is that for any individual, the larger the size of this repeat, the earlier in onset the disease can occur. So while the average onset may be 45, so it is a late middle-aged sort of onset disease, if someone happens to inherit a very large expansion, they can have disease that occurs in their teens, in their 20s, sometimes as early as age 2.
Now, what is the pathophysiology of this disease process? They have the abnormal gene. It obviously creates changes in how the body processes or produces certain proteins.
Yeah.
So what happens then?
This disease, while relatively rare, actually shares a lot of similarity with more common neurodegenerative diseases in that it's caused by a misfolded or an abnormal protein. Very similar in many ways to the underlying problems in Alzheimer's disease, in Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and Parkinson's disease. So these relatively more common neurodegenerative diseases share this one property, that the cells in the body, and specifically the cells in the brain called neurons, accumulate abnormal misfolded protein. And in the case of Huntington's disease, it's the protein created by the gene, the Huntington gene, and the protein is called Huntington. So what happens is this expansion that I discussed, the change in the gene, leads to a corresponding change in the protein, and there's a stretch of the same amino acid, which is the building blocks of protein. And so if you have an expansion in the gene, you get an expansion in the number of these amino acids in the protein, and that protein then has new abnormal, it sort of misfolds, it doesn't shape properly, and then it can stick to itself, it can stick to other proteins, and over time it'll accumulate and form what are called inclusions or aggregations, so it sticks to itself and it sticks to other proteins. And over time, and we don't know the exact mechanism because there are many different postulated mechanisms, it will injure brain cells and cause the disease.
What was the basic science that led to this, the collaborative research, and generated the questions that the group wanted to answer?
So, I mean, Huntington's disease is a really Huntington's disease research is a really unique field in that it's really a sort of an area in medical science today that is sort of, I think it really pioneered modern collaborative scientific research. So in 1993, when the gene defect that causes this disease was discovered, it wasn't discovered by one person or one scientist or even one lab or researchers from one university. The group that discovered it published under a group name, and it was a collaborative research effort to identify. And that collaborative spirit has continued throughout Huntington's disease research. So a collaborative group discovered the gene. The gene was found to make this abnormal protein, and hundreds of researchers have published data over the last 15 years on how that abnormal protein affects different brain cells. Now, many researchers in the field were focused exclusively on the brain and on the type of brain cells called neurons. But there are other brain cells that are supporting players, glia, and a specific type of supporting cell called a microglia, which is very similar to the immune systems in the rest of our body. So microglia in the brain are very much like a cell called a macrophage, which is an immune cell in our blood or in tissues in our body. And there were hints and some very interesting recent information that suggested that not only are brain cells affected, but that other cells in the brain, such as microglia, are also affected by the abnormal protein, the abnormal mutant Huntington protein.
Can you describe your study design?
Sure. The project that was published recently actually came directly out of another publication. So many of the individuals in this collaborative research project were also collaborating on the previous paper. And in that previous paper, we undertook what's called a proteomic approach. So we were trying to ask the question, what are some of the proteins in the body that are changed when this abnormal gene is present? Mm-hmm. So in patients with Huntington's disease, if you take an unbiased look and you try and look at every protein you can and try and identify, is there a different level of this protein in the patients versus control? So we took an unbiased proteomics approach, and we looked at plasma or the fluid from blood from Huntington's patients and from family members and controls and unaffected individuals. And we also looked at cerebral spinal fluid from Huntington's patients and from controls. And we looked at samples from across the world, so from Sweden, from Germany, from England, from Canada. And these were sent off to a number of collaborators, and they looked at all the proteins they could identify and looked at where different levels were. And what was very interesting was both in the cerebral spinal fluid, which is the fluid that covers the brain, as well as in the plasma, which is the fluid that blood cells float in, there were some very similar changes that reflected immune activation.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that original proteomics study, we then tried to see whether or not we could model that in certain systems and whether we could, using a more directed approach, identify specifically which immune proteins and immune modulators and what form of activation occurs both in the peripheral system, so the blood and peripheral tissues, and also in the brain. And so that's how this second paper came about. So what we did in the second paper, it's actually, it because it's a large collaborative group and it was quite a large paper, we did many things, so it takes a little while to explain it. But basically we looked in, we looked at specific immune proteins, immune modulators, and we looked in human plasma. We looked in postmortem brain samples from individuals who had died from Huntington's disease or had died from other reasons. We looked at cerebral spinal fluid again from Huntington's patients and correlated that with changes in their plasma. And we, our group, and several other groups have developed very interesting mouse models of Huntington's disease. And in a mouse model, in each of these cases, these are mice that have been genetically modified to carry the human gene, or in some cases, portions of the human gene, or even just the mutated part of the human gene. And these mice will express some of the features of Huntington's disease. So we can, in the mice, look again at brain tissue. We can isolate individual types of cells and see how the abnormal protein causes this change in the immune system.
And what were your findings then with respect to these changes and the immune abnormalities?
Well, one of the most exciting findings in this paper was that we could identify immune changes that were predictable and fairly robust and really quite dramatic in individuals that carried the Huntington's gene but didn't have any symptoms at all. And one of the unique things about Huntington's disease is, again, we know exactly what causes it, and based on genetic testing, we can predict in a population-based manner at what age a predicted we can sort of predict in a general way. We can't do it for individuals, but if we have groups of subjects, we can predict what their average age of onset should be based on the size of the genetic change. So based on those calculations, we can take people that don't have any symptoms at all, are free of disease, but carry the gene, and we can say that this, you know, the group would have onset in about 15 years. So this is well before, 15
right.
Years before disease, and we can measure changes in their blood that we know are caused by the abnormal protein. And one of the reasons this is so critical, and this is why we undertook all of these research projects, is we have an opportunity to intervene in this disease before symptoms occur. And that's not possible for any other neurodegenerative disease, really, or it's a very unusual situation in neurodegenerative disease. So you can imagine somebody has a gene. If we have has the gene but doesn't have symptoms, we can give them treatment years before they get any symptoms. And if we can prevent the disease from coming, we've cured the from having onset. We've essentially cured the disease.
So you're preventing some of these proteins from actually exerting their effect over that time.
That's a very interesting therapeutic approach. Yes. What a biomarker is, and what these represent is potential biomarkers. A biomarker is something we can measure that reflects a disease process. And you can imagine if somebody is healthy and you want to do a trial of a new therapeutic and you give them a drug that's supposed to prevent disease, well, if they don't have disease, you've got nothing to measure.
Correct.
So it's very hard to do those clinical trials in pre-manifest individuals. So in an individual that doesn't have disease, you can give them a drug, but you've got nothing to measure. Here, what we're trying to find are biomarkers, things we can measure that we are involved in the pathogenesis. So you could imagine a blood test for one of these immune modulators, and we know that the abnormal protein increases it. And if we have a drug that targets that pathway, we can give it to individuals and lower it. This is very much similar to the way blood pressure is used in trials of cardiac disease. Mm-hmm. So blood pressure is in a way, it's a physical biomarker of cardiac disease. And you can give medicines that will lower blood pressure, and an otherwise healthy individual will be protected in the long term against the development of cardiac disease or heart disease. So what we want to do is develop similar, in this case, biochemical biomarkers for Huntington's disease so that we can undertake those long-term studies in which we give individuals targeted therapy and prevent them from ever developing this disease.
So in other words, this study now has sort of paved the route for the group to say, okay, now we have identifiable, quantifiable parameters, variables, proteins that we can measure to really see if treatments or proposed treatments will directly affect the pathophysiology of this disease process.
Yeah, and that's an overall goal of, you know, several very large biomarker initiatives. These are we're the individuals who participated in this research are members of large collaborative groups supported by the Huntington Study Group in North America, the European HD Network, the EHDN in Europe, and So this is a major initiative by all of the sort of research groups studying Huntington's disease to develop these biomarkers. And this paper is one of several papers in the last couple of years that all contribute to this developing field.
Dr. Blair Levitt is senior research neurologist and scientist at the Center for Molecular Medicine and Therapeutics, Child and Family Research Institute at BC Children's Hospital, director of the Canadian Genetic Disease Network Transgenic Core Facility, associate professor, Department of Medical Genetics at UBC, and neurologist, UBC Neurogenetics and Huntington Disease Medical Clinics. And Dr. Levitt, I'd like to thank you very much for providing, I think, a very hopeful outlook for people who suffer from Huntington's or know of family members or friends who have Huntington's. And I can tell that this type of research really does open up a wide door to now identify, quantify, and hopefully produce treatments that can prevent this disease from progressing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all very excited at some of the possibilities that this research and some of the other research we've alluded to have opened up for this devastating disease. And it is, it's a time of incredible hope. I mean, this is a disease where the gene was only identified, 15 years ago, and in the last few years there's been just an incredible wealth of information discovered, and I think we're getting close.
Well, Dr. Levitt, once again, thank you very much.
All right, take care.
And coming up in our second hour, your calls at 1-800-580-2372, 1-800-580-2372. You can start calling in now if you would like. Love to hear from you. Any questions, comments about the show? Like to get your feedback. 1-800-580-2372. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call.